Billy Squire, dick. Maybe not now, but back then he was a dick. He was just awful to deal with. And we'll leave it at that, but it wasn't just me. Everybody that dealt with him. I've had friends that I've only known for a couple of years that have been in the business, and I'll be like, you ever meet Billy Squire? They're like, I want a douche.
Tell us how you really feel, John. No, seriously, don't sugarcoat it. What do you really think of Billy Squire? That's John Lastman, a fixture of FM radio in Minnesota for nearly 40 years, maybe even longer. Welcome to Rock Conversations. I'm Rob Bob, and in the next few minutes, we will share our conversation with John Lastman, who has worn many hats in radio throughout his career, including many years at KQRS, the Minnesota Rocker. And he also has this buddy that hangs out with him on occasion called the Chucker. And if we're lucky, I'm going to ask if the Chucker is with John today, if we might be able to talk to the Chucker a little as well. You never know. You know, sometimes those creative artists can be a little fussy. Anyway, John Lastman is credited. He and a friend who worked in radio in New York are both credited with giving Bon Jovi his first airplay. He'll tell us that story and many more. Some housekeeping items real quickly. Thanks for tuning in to our podcast, Rock Conversations. You can subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, Audible. And if you would take a few seconds to rate the individual interviews, the podcast, that would be great. Much appreciated. So without further ado, let's get to our conversation with John Lastman.
Oh, let's go back, let's go back, let's go back again.
So let's start at the beginning. Maybe not quite the beginning, but your first round at KQRS, if I'm not mistaken, you joined the staff sometime in the mid-80s, went till the mid-90s, give or take. How would you describe the culture at the station back then?
My first round at Power Radio, that was the early to mid-80s. I had come back from New York City with the my tail between my legs, back literally moving back into my parents' basement, going to college. And the nicest guy, Doug Sorensen, who was the program director at the time, he took a chance. He kept saying, I don't get it. You worked in New York City and you want to do weekends at KQ? This was before KQ had its huge ratings. Tom wasn't there yet. Dave Hamilton wasn't there yet. So I got hired, and we were, you know, a five-share rock radio station in the middle of, you know, top 40 nightmares with MTV on fire. And, you know, it was Culture Club and all that 80s top 40 stuff, Michael Jackson. And we were playing Twisted Sister, and things didn't really come together for another year or so. But yeah, I got in there right around 84, 85.
Were you still, was the station still doing battle with KDWB? If I recall, you were Minnesota's Rockin' Best and they were the Twin Cities Rockin' Best back in the day.
No, by that time, KDWB had flipped to top 40 to take okay. on the 10-share WLOL. So for rock, KQ was really the only game in town, and they, you know, had a 5-share. It wasn't happening. So I joined sort of what they thought was a sinking ship, but it was a sleeping giant, as it turned out, you know?
It's got to be kind of cool to look back. I know that, you know, generally looking back isn't always fun, but you were there, as you say, where, you know, the station, if it wasn't sinking, it might have been close to it. Mm-hmm. And then within a couple of years, it saw this meteoric rise, and you were part of it. You know, Tom's arrival in the morning, certainly Tom Bernard, for those of, yep. of our listeners who aren't quite familiar with the market, you know, really catapulted the station to a whole nother level. But you got to see it kind of firsthand as it was growing and then as it succeeded.
Yeah, you know what people forget, and I've talked to Tom about this, Tom was there a good year, year and a half before those ratings really took off. And it wasn't until the Twins in 87 went to the World Series, and he was such a baseball fanatic, he was able to talk about it in a whole different way. You know, that CCO would be, you know, CCO talk. He was doing his own thing. And just like the Twins, his, you know, winning streak went up and up and kept growing and growing. So, yeah, it was I was a little young to really, you know, take it all in for what it was. I just knew, look, I was keep talking about the money all the time. I wasn't making any money, but I was what, 23, 24 years old, maybe. And I was on this rocket ship, and I knew that things were really coming together when my father, bless his soul, he was the head of the ear, nose, and throat department at the University of Minnesota for 51 years. And he never acknowledged my, you know, DJ-ness, as if you will. He thought radio was, you know, it was a phase that I would grow out of. Well, one day, about a year into the arrival of the KQ Morning Show, he said to me, well, one of my grad students asked if I was the Chuckers' father, so I guess you've made it. And
all because of your alter ego. We'll get into Chuck a little later.
Pretty big. I mean, for him, that was a big deal. So, yeah, I saw it go from a five share, and it was, you know, like I said, after about a year, all of a sudden we popped to a seven, and then an eight. And then I remember when we had a 12-1. I mean, that was crazy. And, you know, it was more, I made more in bar gigs than I did from being on the air at that time. But it was all for the best.
Let's talk about the music a little, because I think you wore the hat as music director at some point, right? That I think you were, yes. You ran the marketing department at one point, maybe assistant program director. I don't want to dwell on the titles, but you certainly, and not to mention on air, you know, that's how I was first exposed to you doing when you were doing weekends, I think evenings, right?
Yeah, I did weekends for a while. And then, I was made music director like right around 87, 88. And that was great because it was a chance to really, things that would affect the ratings. So I could guide the music to a certain extent. And
yeah, let's talk a little bit about that in more detail. If I recall, and sometimes as I get older, my memory is a little faulty.
Yes.
But if I recall, KQ in the late 80s was playing a fair amount of new rock and roll, usually by established artists that you had been playing for years, but it wasn't just the classic rock that we know today. Is that memory correct?
Correct. That was sort of the format itself. You didn't really have classic rock stations come on till, I don't know, the late 80s. And at the time, there was Cool 108, but they were still playing the Big Bopper and Buddy Holly and 50s music. And maybe the Beatles, but they wouldn't, you know, none of that Sgt. Pepper hippie stuff. It was all the I want to hold your hand. So we were able to play currents and classics. And it wasn't all just by established artists. You know, we did play Guns N' Roses and those type of artists when they came out. But they fit well into that format because you could play them next to an older Beatles record at the time. And that was what was fun about being a music director. Being a music director of a classic rock station, well, that's one thing. But when you're young, you're in your 20s yourself, and you're able to influence new music that gets played on your favorite radio station, that's different. So that was cool. And I got to know everybody, you know, in the business, good or bad, more bad than good. But for the most part, very, very positive, and music director. And then I was given the 6 to 10 p.m. air shift right around 87. They needed some young blood in that radio station because Hot Rock and 104 had signed on, and that station didn't do much between 6 a.m. and, I don't know, 4 p.m., but they were on fire at night. I mean, they were
interesting,
beating KQ and almost beating, you know, the Twins on CCO. They owned the market when the younger crowd was listening at the time. Yes, there was a time when people listened to the radio at night.
Well, it's interesting you talk about the share, and I don't want to get too inside baseball here, but the share back then meant so much more because so many more people were actually listening to what we call terrestrial radio. You didn't have all these other options. And so when you're getting a share of whatever it might have been, a couple million in a market of prospective listeners, at least, it was a big deal. Music-wise, obviously you had a role in discovering and getting airplay for Bon Jovi, but I will tease that and save that for later. When you were at KQ, were there any artists, either new or old, that had new music that you added to the rotation and, you know, you were really proud of that maybe other stations nationally hadn't quite caught on to and you were blazing the trail, if you will?
Right. Well, I just mentioned Guns N' Roses, and I'll go back to that because of, and I just mentioned Hot Rock and 104. I'll give credit where credit's due. Hot Rock and 104 was very aggressive on new rock. That was their thing. So at night between 6 and 10, or starting at 6 p.m., you know, I was the platform for new music. So, yes, I played KQ was the, what was it? The third radio station in America to play Guns N' Roses because KNAC in L.A. was first because they were from L.A., so they were local, and they were a bar band. So KNAC played them first, and then Hot Rockin', because nobody was as aggressive as Hot Rockin' on hard rock, so they played it. But because they played it, I played it.
Ah,
and,
okay.
You know, maybe KQ gets credit for playing them third. I don't know if they do, but that was because of Hot Rockin' 104. But Hot Rock and 104 also played a lot of new music that didn't turn out to be Guns N' Roses. There was, you know, I didn't play a lot of solo Ace Frehley like they did. Love him or hate him, but, you know, you had to draw the line.
Yeah, so. I'm not sure you deserve blame or credit for this, but I'll throw it out there anyway. I remember in the early days of listening, you know, whenever I could tune in, because I was, you know, I was living in Winona at the time, still in high school, so it wasn't as easy to tune in to KQ. You know, if the weather was right, we might be able to pick it up. Otherwise, I had to have a, you know, buddy do some taping and send it to me. But I recall in those early days, I loved REM, still do love some of their stuff. But if it was you who added the one I loved to the rotation, I don't know if I can forgive you. Because all I can do, I can hear Tom's voice in my head, you know, 92 KQRS, here's REM. Down, 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 down. It was like every morning.
Yeah, don't blame me. That was Dave Hamilton, the program director, and he got the REM bug. This is kind of interesting because he spent a year or so programming a country station in, of all places, Boston. But because, and he wasn't a country guy, but he needed a job. But he was a rock programmer, so all he did was listen to WBCN, which is arguably one of the iconic album rock stations of
all
time. Well, and leave it to BCN to be playing REM in 1983 or 4 before it was fashionable. So when he got to KQ, I remember the first one was Radio Free Europe, and I was like, what is this? And then it just went from there. So, yeah.
I'll blame him then. I'll blame him. Speaking of Dave, he was the program director at KQ for a number of years. I heard a recent podcast with you and Tom talking about him a little. I think you described him as half genius, half crazy, or something along those lines.
I think I compared him to, not to date myself, but Professor Irwin Corey, who was the comic that would come out with the looking like Einstein with the hair, and he was just a nut. Dave was, he was a evil genius. And he'd be the first to admit it. He was great, though. I mean, I won't put anything past him. He had the smarts and, at the time, the budget to run circles around the competition. I mean, if the competition was giving away a trip to see the Stones in New York, Dave had the wherewithal to within, you know, a day be on the air with a trip to Europe to see the Stones. He could always outspend you, outsmart you. And even when, I mean, there's the classic that we were giving away, it was like a car a day. It was the Suzuki Samurai. And it literally, I think, was a car a day for like 2 weeks. Well, right, like after 2 days of being on the air, the Suzuki Samurais get recalled because they were flipping over if you turned left to over 30 miles an hour. If you took a hard left, they'd flip. Well, it was Dave that came up with the rock and roll over, and you could take the car or you could take $30,000, you know, or whatever they were valued at. It was brilliant, and it was great, and it taught me something about self-deprecation that I still sort of do to this day. You know, nobody wants to hear how great one is. You listen to Howard Stern, you'll never hear him talk about how big his wiener is. He'll say how small his wiener is.
Yes, he will.
Yes, constantly. But you know what I mean? It's like, okay, I get it. And that was one of the first times it was like, nobody wants to hear that you're wonderful. People like it when you're down and out, but you make a comeback. So,
John Lastman is joining us on Rock Conversations. He's he's been a fixture of radio throughout Minnesota, largely in the Twin Cities for many years. You're now working in St. Cloud. Let's give a shout out to the station there. And where can people listen to you these days if they want to tune in the morning?
Well, I am the morning man / operations manager, whatever that means, at Rockin' 101, WHMH, which is a 30-year heritage rock station. Actually was born out of the good people that lost their jobs at Hot Rockin' 104 because of me and the crew at KQ that, you know, drove them out of the format 30-plus years ago. They went to St. Cloud, and they started the station, and the station's been very successful. It's had its ups and downs, but I've always known about it. It wasn't like this second-tier wannabe rock station. It was sort of, I wouldn't say respected, but yeah, it was known, and it was not a place that was thought of as, you know, a redheaded stepchild. So it's a real deal. Good people, great company. I've never worked for, you know, a family run business like that, but I love it.
Good.
I've only been here 4 months. Talk to me in 6 months, but no,
I'll do that.
No,
I'll do that.
It's great. I'm having a ball doing mornings. I, you know, I'm given the opportunity to, succeed or fail on a daily basis. And I have no ratings to judge it by, but so far so good. We have guests on every day.
Yeah, the guest lineup, if people want to follow you or friend you on Facebook, you do a good job of promoting the following day's show.
Well, and, thank you.
Yeah, and the guest lineup is really strong. So I encourage people who miss John. And is the Chucker with you today?
Is he with me? Is he in studio or is he here?
Well, is he there? I mean, you know, are we allowed to talk to him or can we only talk about him?
Oh, no. I got to go get him. He's in the basement. But okay. You go, give me a second here. Hold on. Yeah. Chucker, it's that podcast. I don't know. They've had enough of my pontification. They want to hear the glory of you, of course. All right. Hold on. He'll be here in a second.
Okay.
He's down there working on, you know.
Well, I hope so. I hope he's not freeloading too much.
Yeah, hello. Freeloading? I'll have you know nobody works harder at the radio broadcasting. Who is this? Is this Rob Halford?
This is Rob Hahn. But you can call me Rob Bob.
To come again?
Rob Bob. That's with two B's right next to each other. Did you ever see Fletch, Chucker?
Fletch, the movie, you know, with
like
Bill Murray.
Babar, B-A-B-A-R. Is that with one B or two Bs? Okay, I digress.
Babar, the French elephant?
Yes, the French elephant.
And we may have to start this over.
Oh, well, the Chuckster, it's good to talk to you. Let's look back at your storied career for a little bit. Is it even fair to ask if you have a favorite interview or two that you've done over the three decades or so that you've been on the airwaves?
You mean besides this one?
Well, yes, besides this one. Thank you.
Well, it's hard to pick just one, you know. People like the old Michael Jackson because it's one of the first ones. Michael Jackson was nice enough to join us on there. Turned out it was just some guy named Mike Jackson from Watts. But he had me fooled for a while. But that's a real old one. People like, I like Barbara Babcock from the old TV show. I thought she was on Leave It to Beaver, and she set me straight. She got rather upset.
I'm trying to think of the one that I liked. I think it was Rob Schneider from SNL.
Oh yes,
he was a little confused. Copies, I think. Yeah.
He lost his patience. He actually asked for John Lastman, Johnny Rock,
who had I remember
to come
that
to the phone. One of the few times I've allowed Johnny Rock to share the spotlight. But about 25 years later, he was in studio at Power Radio, and I didn't have the heart to, you know, bring it up, but that was sort of surreal.
Was he in the studio making copies?
He had moved on from that, but at the time, boy, that was his. He wouldn't stop with that shtick. Holy God! But there was those, you know.
My two other favorites, if I could opine real quickly, would be Fred Savage, because I thought he played along with it very well.
Oh, he was a sweet, sweet kid.
Yeah. Chuckster, I think he kept calling you, or Chuck.
Yes.
And Bob Weir. I'm not sure Bob Weir appreciated the Grateful Dead jokes, but I thought they were hilarious.
You know, that's another favorite. Bob Weir, if you listen back to it, you can find these online, or you can just listen to the old Johnny Rock show and Rockin' 101. Yeah, Bob Weir actually laughed at some of them. I liked what does a Grateful Dead head say when they finally run out of weed? Good Lord, what is this horrible music? You know, it's interesting. It's sort of the bigger the ego, the better the interview with the Chuckster. If you can always tell if they really get upset, well, that's the real them. You know, Carrot Top didn't have a long fuse. He lost it. And, you could go on and on. There's been so many.
Well, it's great to talk to you. I'm going to let you get back to work in the basement because no one works harder than you, right? And if you could find John again, that would be great. I got a few more questions for him. Thank you, Chuck.
Okay, hold on. Thank you, Rob Halford. Hold on. Yeah. Hey, Casey Kasem. He's ready for you again.
Oh my God, this guy's a roommate.
Okay, I'm back.
I don't know what I envision when I hear that he's in the basement, you know, I mixing up some chemicals or something.
Well, he's mixing up, you know, he has a
little
studio
John Hyatt
down there.
Yeah.
He's got his own, he's got his own scene. He goes down there and these things don't just happen. He's got to edit and produce and he works on them day and night.
John Lastman is our guest. I don't want to take too much of your time, but I've got just a few questions left. Let's talk about Bon Jovi. You're certainly credited, and rightly so, with helping get him airplay. Tell us the story. I don't want to, belabor what I may or may not know, so I'll let you just run with it.
Well, so we have another hour to talk about Bon Jovi, because that's, I know my Bon Jovi.
For those that don't know the story, it almost gets to be a cliche with me. I've made jokes about it on the air, and the Chuckster gives me a hard time on the air. Calls him my lover, Bon Jovi, because
you make a nice couple. Now that I think of it,
cute. If he's paying, I'm playing. The cat's worth $410 million. Last time I checked. No, I was out in New York City. Going to college, really going to radio station WAPP, which was the brand new station. And we were so new, he likes to say that you could just walk into the
the front lobby. Well, even, you know, when we weren't so new a year later, you could still walk into the front lobby. This was just a burned out shell. Well, exactly, it was a burned out shell. It was, you know, the competition was in Manhattan at 30 Rock with, you know, glorious studios and security and people like Don Imus working there. Well, we had this building in Queens. And actually, it was on the Long Island Expressway. And it was next to a disco that had had a fire. So it was burned out. The station wasn't, but it sure smelled of smoke. And we were in there. I was 18, making 12. And they made me promotion director because no one else would do it. And that was basically vice president of hanging up banners at local clubs and, you know, making sure all the DJ appearances went okay. And then I was lucky enough to, you know, get on the air weekend overnights, which was amazing in New York City. And we were doing this hometown album project. If you remember, 101 did it here, where you would, if you were a local band, you would submit your tape.
Sure. Yep.
Now, kids, you don't know, you and your silly, you know, apps and programs
those,
that you
and
can
MP3
cut records
files,
in.
Right?
Yes, you can cut records in your bedroom. In my day, you couldn't just set it up on a desktop computer. We didn't have those. You had to rent studio time. And it was like, you might as well have been Fleetwood Mac wanting to go in and cut a demo. It was expensive and, you know, no one could really do it. So the happening bands locally in New York would give me almost reel-to-reel tapes, and they were produced pretty well. They were done at a professional studio, and then you could tell who wasn't happening because they were done literally in a garage, and it sounded like, well, I got Twisted Sister, that was the biggest bar band on Long Island at the time. They agreed to do the album, and of course, their song sounded really good because it was produced at a real studio. And then I had a bunch of other bands that didn't sound very good. Well, this kid walked into the front lobby and gave me his, it was a cassette. And his name was John Bon Jovi, spelled B-O-N-G-I-O-V-I. And I didn't know how he was going to sound, but he sure was pretty. But seriously, I listened to the song, and the first thing that struck me was the production value of it. Not even the song itself that turned out to be, he still, you know, plays it every night in concert, but the production value was as good, if not better, than any of the other stuff I had heard. And I called him and I said, look, I can't help but notice you sound like you're, I don't know, at the time, you know, on a 24-track recording studio. Like, what's going on? He goes, oh, well, my uncle owns the power station, which is, hold on, Chuck, what would you call it?
The power station.
All right. The power station, which was one of the bigger recording studios in Manhattan. David Bowie had just recorded the Let's Dance album there. So it was a real recording studio. And now the legend is that he would sweep up during, you know, the day and hang out. And for his time, his uncle would let him use the recording studio after people had left. So on this cassette, he's singing, but on guitar is a bunch of musicians that were in and around the studio. So on the, not his band, because his band didn't exist yet. Richie Sambora wasn't, you know, there was no Bon Jovi, the band. So on the demo he gave me, keyboards are Roy Bittan of the E Street Band, because he was in there doing something for somebody. Guitar is Aldo Nova, because he was in there recording the follow-up to Fantasy, his one big hit. And it goes on and on. So wow. I was like, well, good
That's
Lord.
Incredible.
Okay. So I obviously put him on the album. The national winner of that contest, because it was through Miller Beer, and stations all over the country did, you know, each market did an album. And we were the New York station. The winner got a quote-unquote record deal with Atlantic Records, which if you did a deep dive was like for, you know, one single. It wasn't, no one was awarding multi-year record deals to local bands from a radio station contest. Well, by the time John Bon Jovi had won the national prize, he had already secured a really good record deal with Mercury Records. And, you know, first couple albums were what they were. He was on his way to becoming the next winger when Slippery When Wet came out. And I guess, you know, you can say the rest is history. So I kept in contact with him as much as I could. He's a hell of a businessman. When he was doing 14 million copies sold, you couldn't get near him. And when Nirvana came out, you couldn't get rid of him, you know?
You had told me that in advance of this interview, I'd asked you, you know, for some prep material, and mm-hmm. somehow you avoided Bon Jovi's $50 million mistake. What exactly is that?
Oh, the $50 million. No, yes. I didn't avoid it. He avoided it.
Okay.
It's a funny story. He was in town in Minneapolis for two or three nights at the old Met Center. It was on the New Jersey tour, follow-up to Slippery When Wet. Second or third night, we all went downtown to a called Solid Gold, which was this jazz club, and they had great jazz music. No, it was a strip club, but it was one of those high-end strip joints. And we all wound up in the Champagne Lounge, and it was John and Richie, and I think the whole band was there, and some management. And the women in the club, and there was, you know, like 30 strippers at a time in this club. It was over the top. They were like lining up to get up to the Champagne Lounge to meet these guys. And I leaned over to John. I'll never forget. I said, boy, look at you. Which one's it going to be? Which ones is it going to be? You could take 30 of them home. And he looked at the girls and he looked at me. He goes, buddy, that would be the $50 million mistake. So right there, you could even way back then, he knew that he was married and that he wasn't going to go out that way. He was too smart for that.
A shrewd businessman with a good moral compass.
Well, a good money compass, if nothing else. He knew his wife would take him to the cleaners. So plus, you know, look, he didn't need to. He could probably get 50 women anywhere. It didn't have to be at the strip club, so he's no dummy.
One final Bon Jovi note. He gave a nice shout-out to you at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction. That had to be super cool. What was that like?
Oh, that was really, really nice, you know. And I don't talk about this that much as far as why I was there. The afternoon DJ at WAPP, he was Chip Hobart. And I put Bon Jovi on the album, and then Chip was the first DJ in the world to play them on the radio, because part of the deal was you played songs off your album to promote it. Well, obviously, we played Runaway. It was the best song on the album. So Chip got cancer a few years back, and I had heard this, and I had not been in touch with Chip for a while, but I reached out to him when I heard Bon Jovi was being inducted, and I had secured a pair of tickets, and I said, look, if you can get yourself to Cleveland, I'll get you into the Hall of Fame induction, which is no easy ticket, and I'd love to go with you. And long story short, we wound up going together. He didn't know that John was going to thank us on stage, but John thanked both of us with Howard Stern over his shoulder, which was made it even more bizarre. And
just a little, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. And Chip passed away a couple months ago. I did say on the air on Rockin' 101, I'm so glad I got a chance to spend that time with him. It sounds cliche, but it really meant a lot to him, and it meant a lot to me, and we were able to reunite before he passed. And I still talk to his daughter all the time. She said it meant so much to her dad, so that's nice. And it
was
nice.
Pretty awesome.
I tell you what, Elvis would have given me a Cadillac, though. I don't need the glad handing. Give me a car. But
yeah, you know,
it was very nice of John. It got me a lot of press, I'll tell you that. I was on the cover of Variety and Billboard. It was nice because it made for a good story beyond just the fact that they were going in the Hall of Fame, the fact that he remembered people. And it was funny, later in the telecast or in the ceremony, the Moody Blues all of a sudden started thanking this DJ from WMMS or something in Cleveland. And I think they added that at the last minute when they John did. So maybe. Who knows?
Yeah.
But it was nice. And he and John didn't know I was going to be there. So backstage in the press room, you know, you see it on the Oscars after they do their speech, they go into this room where all the press is and people are shouting out questions. Well, I shouted out a question and he recognized me and called me up on stage, me and Chip. It was great. It was
nice.
Fun.
Nice.
Yeah.
Tell me quickly about the night that you met Freddie Mercury and Andy Warhol. I mean, what a combo.
Yeah. Again, you know, I'm 18, 19 years old in New York City at a time when New York City was rough. I mean, this isn't your Walt Disney World that it is now down on Times Square. This is right. Yeah. Go see Taxi Driver or Midnight Cowboy. It's a little before this time, but
yeah, I think you could purchase a few illegal things around Times Square back then.
Yes. Yes. So, Queen and Billy Squire were playing Madison Square Garden and they did a post concert party that, if you've seen the movie Bohemian Rhapsody, there's a scene where Freddie throws a party and he's being carried on the shoulders of his assistant wearing a crown like the Queen. And that scene is tamed to the real thing. This was held at the Danceteria, which was a big time avant-garde disco. It's famous for Madonna was a dancer there, but not at the time. So we're at this party and it's after the concert. So it's, you know, 2-3 in the morning and I'm with, of all people, Chip Hobart. And I see this guy by the bar surrounded by a bunch of other goofballs. And I said, look at that guy trying to look like Andy Warhol. Who does he think he is? And Chip looks at him and he looks at me and goes, you idiot. That is Andy Warhol. Well, of course it was. We're in Manhattan at 3 a.m. in 1983, 84. Yes. And then all of a sudden the record promoter came up with Freddie doing his obligatory meet the radio people. And I mean, it was 30 seconds of a great concert. Thank you for the music. You liked the concert, did you? Well, thank you for coming. And he was gone. But
all that was missing can't thank you enough for the time.
Well, that the Chucker was not there that night, but if you ask him, I'm sure he'd claim he was, you know.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Now, it wasn't planned this way, but a friend of mine, good friend named Laura, the other day asked me if I could somehow do a segment or work in a reference to Billy Squire. And there you did. You said he opened for Queen. So did you like Squire as a performer back in the day?
Boy, he got a talk about cancel culture. He got canceled before we knew what it was. He did that video for Rock Me Tonight. And just because he was wearing a loose fitting tank top and sort of danced around a little footloose and fancy free, people didn't want to hear about him anymore. But he was a great performer. But I'll tell you what, Billy, if you're listening, and who's your friend that loves Billy Squire?
Laura.
Laura, if you're listening, Billy Squire, dick. Maybe not now, but back then he was a dick. He was just awful to deal with. And we'll leave it at that. But it wasn't just me. Everybody that dealt with them. I've had friends that I've only known for a couple of years that have been in the business. And I'll be like, you ever meet Billy Squire? They're like, oh, what a douche. So, yeah, he had a huge ego. But he was big at the time. He was arguably as big as Queen because Queen... they weren't putting out big hits. It was after Another One Bites the Dust by about 3 years. Yeah. But Billy Squire was just coming out of My Kind of Lover and Don't Say No, that whole era. And he had just put out Emotions in Motions. In fact, who did the cover for Emotions in Motion? Andy Warhol.
I did not know that.
Thus the connection. And, you know, I'm sure Andy knew Queen too. But, it all makes sense now.
So who else, and I don't want to belabor it too long, but if you were to throw in two or three other rock musicians who would rival Billy Squire on the dick factor scale, who would they be?
That's not fair. I don't know. I got one. Remember The Church? They had a great song, Under the Milky Way.
Sure I do. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. I was interviewing them. And to be fair, I wasn't a big, you know, church fan, so I didn't know much about them. But I remember saying, tell us about the new album, which is a, you know, that's a softball question. You should be able to just, you know, spew out some titles and the producer. Well, the lead singer goes, well, the new album, it's rather black, somewhat round. Okay. Hilarious. So they were difficult to deal with. I'll tell you who, you got to love them. Frank Zappa was a dick, but he had every right to be. And I didn't interview him. Chip Hobart did, but I was there in the studio. And it was during Valley Girl was out, which was his biggest hit. And he was, you know, happening again.
It was a great tune in its own way.
Yes, he was at this was a WAPP. Chip did a Sunday morning show, which was all 60s music. And it was on from like 9 to 11 or something. Well, he was pre-taping Frank Zappa, and he didn't want to hear about Valley Girl. He wanted to talk about the 60s and the mothers of invention and all this. But Frank didn't come there. This was, you know, a Thursday afternoon. He didn't come out to Long Island Expressway to talk about old music. So Chip would, you know, wouldn't hear of it. And he didn't want to be taped. He wanted to go on the radio. So I'll never forget Chip's like, so let's talk about the mothers of invention. How did you guys first get together in 63? And he goes, oh, that's a fascinating story, Chip. You know, oh, never mind. And he just kept saying, oh, never mind to every question, to the point that Chip finally had to stop the tape and basically bag the interview. So that was good. Oh, I have one.
Okay.
Oh, boy. Here's one more. I think about 1990, they finally banned smoking indoors at most establishments, including the radio station, you know, Power Radio 92. So there's no more smoking. And you have to understand, at the time in that building, everybody smoked on the air, off the air, the salespeople. It was right out of Mad Men. And you couldn't smoke. You could go outside and smoke. So, of all people, John Mellencamp comes by for an interview, and
he's been known to pop a heater or two. Yeah.
Oh, so I said to him, he sits down and in the studio, and again, I wasn't interviewing him. I think Wally Walker was, but I was put in charge of babysitting him. So I said, "Hey, would you like a Coca-Cola or something?" He's like, "Oh, sure, I'd love a soda." So I go to get him a pop. And I come back, and he's smoking. And I said, oh, I'm sorry. We just passed this rule. The general manager is saying no more smoking in the building. It's a law now. You understand. And he looks at me and goes, kid, I can smoke my cigarette and do this interview, or I can put out my cigarette and not do this interview. Keep smoking. So, yeah, old John Mellencamp. But for the most part, people are pretty good. They're on their best behavior if they're professionals and they're not, you know, they know they're doing an interview. It's not like I'm not the chucker. I'm not calling them out of the blue sometimes. I'm just
going, they're there to promote themselves, are they not? So they should be somewhat gracious and grateful.
Yes, yes.
But you have, you know, on the flip side, do you have one or two that stand out as being just spectacular or doing something so unique in a positive way that it'll always stick with you?
I'm trying to think. I know Robert Plant was surprisingly prepared and together and positive when he didn't have to be, you know, Robert Plant, for God's sake. And even someone like Ozzy, who's, you know, out there, he knew what he was talking about. He knew about the record, you know.
Cool.
Yeah. There's really, you know, the young bands are excited to be there, and the veterans, well, some are excited to still be there, or they've done it so many times, it's like, you know, nothing to them.
Final question. We're talking to John Lastman. Who haven't you interviewed in the music world that would be on your list, at the top of the list?
Prince.
Okay.
Met him twice, but never interviewed him. And I think that's 90% of the people in the industry can say that. But Prince, you know, you have a laundry list of bands that I was. How old do you think I am? I never saw Led Zeppelin in concert. I saw the Plant Page gig, which was close, but it still wasn't Led Zeppelin.
Right.
Never interviewed the Stones. Met them. Never interviewed them. Let's see.
Did you go to Russia or the old Soviet Union to see the Stones as part of a promotion?
You've done your research. Yes, we in 91, Budweiser did a promotion where they, like 20 radio stations, were going to go to Moscow because the Stones were going to play the Lenin Stadium. And it was going to be this big, called it the Rock and Roll Summit. And by the time we brought two winners there, and by the time we got there, the Stones had decided the ruble was so worthless on the world market, they were going to lose too much money playing in Russia. So we got diverted to Copenhagen, where we saw the Stones play a soccer stadium that was amazing. And then they wanted nothing to do with Russia. So we all the winners went to Russia, but no Stones included. We could do a whole nother podcast on that trip. Oy vey.
We'll save that for another time, because I know I've taken more time than I said I was going to, but I appreciate all the great stories, John. John Lastman, thanks so much for joining us on Rock Conversations.
Listen, as the Chucker would say, Rob Halford, you're a delight. But thank you. Hang in there, all right?